Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Kernegas, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is the man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests to appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Dawn. Great to be here. Today's episode represents a first for STEM Talk. Our conversation with Dr. Tommy Wood, who is a UK-trained physician, he's a PhD MD actually, was so fascinating and went on for more than 2 hours that we decided to break our interview with Tommy into two parts.
Yeah, we indeed had a fun time talking to Tommy, whose interests range from the treatment of multiple sclerosis to metabolic disease to sports performance. The second part of our interview with Tommy will upload to iTunes on October 10th, so be on the lookout. But before we get to today's interview with Tommy, we have some housekeeping to take care of. We really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all the wonderful 5-star reviews that are piling up on iTunes. As we announced in several earlier episodes, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing the iTunes reviews with an eye towards selecting the wittiest and lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Those are really nice t-shirts. Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the nickname Aaron72. It's titled Welcome Legitimacy. It reads, I always enjoy STEM Talk presentations, so much so, in fact, that I've resorted to slowing down the interviews with pauses and interruptions on my iPad in order to savor and appreciate those refreshing moments of lucidity and newness proffered by your guests. And besides the obvious takeaways inherently associated with new information, which I've come to expect and hugely anticipate, it is also clear that passion, truth, and simplicity share meaningful connectedness in our human experience.
Thank you, Aaron72, and thank you to all the other STEM Talk listeners who have helped STEM Talk get off to such a great start.
And now, on to today's interview with Dr. Tommy Wood.
Dr. Tommy Wood is an MD PhD who is trained in the United Kingdom and now lives in the US. He received an undergraduate degree in biochemistry from the University of Cambridge before attending medical school at the University of Oxford. He recently completed a PhD in physiology and neonatal brain metabolism and is currently a senior fellow at the University of Washington, where he researches neonatal brain injury.
Tommy is the incoming president of the Physicians for Ancestral Health, an international organization of physicians, healthcare professionals, and medical students that specializes in ancestral health principles for the prevention and treatment of illness.
He is also an experienced rowing, endurance, and strength coach who combines evolutionary principles with modern biochemical techniques to optimize performance. He primarily performs this work with Nourish Balance Thrive, a functional medicine clinic based in California that works largely with athletes, where he is the chief medical officer.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Hi, this is Dawn Kernegas. I'm your host for STEM Talk, and joining us today is Tommy Wood. Tommy, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I think STEM Talk is definitely my favorite podcast, so it's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, that's a great start to the podcast. And also joining us today is Ken Ford.
Hi, Dawn, and hello, Tommy.
Hi.
So, Tommy, let's start off at the beginning. Your parents are Icelandic and British. And although you grew up primarily in the UK, you also went to school in Iceland and Germany and France. What was that like?
It was a lot of fun. It was really great, actually. And I really count my blessings in terms of those experiences. It's definitely daunting turning up at a new school. But as a kid, you're sort of fairly adaptable. And I'd turn up and maybe wouldn't know the local language quite as well. You know, Germany, France, maybe knew a little bit. And then sort of thrown into school and just left to play with the kids. And that's actually the best way to learn. So I've always been fairly good with languages, which definitely helped. And like even now, I guess, based on all of that, even though my spoken French and German, Norwegian, Icelandic isn't that great, I can usually follow a conversation in those languages. So it's always fun to try and do that when I can.
Two of your primary passions have been science and athletics. But growing up, which came first, your interest in science or your interest in athletics?
Oh, definitely science. Both of my parents are academics. They're both scientists, and I literally grew up running around the corridors of academic institutions around the world. And our dinner conversations generally and regularly included the trials and tribulations of applying for grants or the broken LCMS, you know, the mass spec in the department. And actually, I was very uninterested in sport for the majority of my childhood years, and I know my dad tried to get me into sport many times, and actually I would prefer to just get a, you know, one of those science kits you can play with on the kitchen table and blow things up and set fire to stuff. So that's generally how I was as a kid, and you know, over time, as I've feel like I've grown into a science career as much as I can have done by this point, you know, I'm hoping to apply science in you know, whatever aspect of my career that I'm doing at the time.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because you were actually the club captain of the rowing team at Cambridge, and then later you became quite an active ultra-endurance sports enthusiast and also got involved in CrossFit training. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that was a big switch for me, actually, and I should make a slight correction, which is that I didn't captain Cambridge themselves, because that would be quite an impressive feat, and most of the rowers who row for Cambridge tend to be former Olympians, and I never made it quite that far, even though not for the want of trying. But I think, you know, by the time I was 18, sort of 16 to 18, there was a bit of a switch, and I decided that I needed to get fit and go to the gym. And then actually it sort of went too far the other way. And it sort of, I think it's very common that people look at the fronts of magazines and want to look like those guys and be, you know, have huge muscles, look like a bodybuilder or a fitness model or whatever. And, you know, that part of me drove me into all these different sports, try and push my body as hard as I could. And that's everything from single lifts in powerlifting to ultra endurance racing. And that's definitely defined my career now. I will end up working full time with athletes very soon, which you know, I absolutely love. But there's definitely a dark side to it, and we see that in our athletes ourselves, which is that, you know, sport can often, and exercise can often be something that you use to escape a life, or you know, things about yourselves or about yourself or the world around you that maybe you don't quite enjoy, and it stops you from maybe, you know, really thinking about that. So there's definitely a dark side too, and you can take it too far. So that was a really intense kind of 10 years of my life where I dedicated most of my spare time to athletics and athletic performance.
Yeah, I find it pretty interesting. So I understand you currently follow the paleo diet, or mostly you do, and that wasn't the case when you were at Cambridge on the rowing team. So what caused you to change your diet approach?
No, definitely not. There's this, you know, everybody talks about the post-exercise window where you just need to eat lots of calories to recover from whatever session you did. And when I was captain and I was head coach of the medical school boat club at Oxford after my undergraduate degree at Cambridge. And, you know, it was sort of on me to help my athletes recover from whatever training we did. So I would fill these boxes with cakes and cookies and, you know, all those excellent refined carbohydrates that we know we need to perform well at sport. And, you know, looking back, now I know a little bit more, I kind of wish I could have done things differently. But that was, you know, that's what's done at the time. And, you know, even now, college level athletics, university level athletics, that's still what a lot of people are doing. You know, it's just get those calories in no matter what they are. Mm-hmm. But then as I was learning about, you know, different ways of training, so when I first became a coach, I was looking at different things, you know, you could maybe do to improve performance, and I found CrossFit. And I was just looking at the principles, really, as things you could use to train athletes. And then through that, at the time, Rob Wolf was associated with CrossFit, and he had his book about the paleo diet, and I read that, and I sort of found it interesting, but didn't really do much to do with it. But then when I came back later to some dietary aspects, I was looking at multiple sclerosis and how diet can affect that, as well as some other diseases. Then I sort of started to think about it again. And, you know, over time, as you sort of see how food can really affect disease risk, that definitely made me much more cognizant of what I eat. And you're right, I don't really follow a strict paleo diet. I think the paleo idea is kind of falling out of favor slightly because it has some negative connotations with it that some of them are fair, some of them are unfair. But basically just eating whole, real foods. You know, I eat some dairy. I have a Scandinavian heritage, so, you know, can tolerate dairy just fine. But, you know, I don't really find grains or refined grains to be a particularly useful food for pretty much anybody. So I do avoid those as much as I can.
Tommy, you have a pretty extensive academic background. So you got your biochemistry degree from Cambridge and then went on to study medicine at the University of Oxford. You also worked as a junior doctor in central London for 2 years after medical school before moving to Norway to get a PhD in physiology and neuroscience at the University of Oslo. So what motivated you to move both country and field of work?
So at this point, I was still, you know, a very junior doctor. I just worked in central London for a couple of years. And that's the point in the UK where you specialize and you go into specialty training and sort of whatever you want to be a consultant in. That's what we call an attending level doctor in the UK. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. But I also knew that I had basically 4 decades of work ahead of me. So, you know, if it takes some time to kind of figure out what you're going to end up doing, then that's really okay. And I wasn't really worried about being a certain level of anything at a given age. And I always thought that I wanted to continue in research, you know, having done some as part of my undergraduate degree. And I was basically offered a PhD by somebody who I had worked with previously as an undergraduate back in Bristol, where I grew up. So this is she's a professor, she's a neonatologist, and she looks at brain injury in newborn babies. And I worked for her for a couple of summers. She actually helped me, encouraged me to go to medical school. And then she sort of, I met her again. It was at my mum's second wedding, actually. She was there and she'd moved back to Norway at this point, because she's Norwegian originally. And she said, you know, if you don't know what you're going to do next, why don't you just come and do a PhD with me? So, I'm usually one to sort of take up on interesting offers. And I kind of feel like when these things come up, there's usually a good reason behind it for whatever reason. So, I accepted, and it was really great to go and do that.
Yeah, why not do, PhD, just another offer comes up down the line after your medical degree.
Just add another degree.
So a lot of your research is focused on multiple sclerosis, and it sounds like this is something that you're interested in even back in medical school. So why is such an interest in that topic?
Yeah, multiple sclerosis wasn't really something I thought about that much until my mom met my current stepdad. And my stepbrother, who's actually almost exactly my age, has multiple sclerosis. And my stepdad is a chemical engineer. And what chemical engineers are really good at, probably better than almost anybody else, is solving problems. That's basically what they're trained to do. So, when you're a chemical engineer and your son gets diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, you just think, well, this is just one big problem that I have to solve. And we basically looked at, over 1,000 papers on everything that could potentially be related to both the development and the progression of multiple sclerosis. So genetics, diet, certain infections, certain toxic exposures, latitude and sunlight are obviously something that people might know about. And then there are also some vascular issues, some blood vessel issues in the brain that might be associated with multiple sclerosis. So we just built models, basically these big interconnected models, to see where these things kind of interact and where we can maybe intervene. And a lot of the stuff that we do is, again, dietary and lifestyle based, and that's really, it's very low risk stuff. And maybe there aren't huge randomized controlled trials that tell us that that's actually exactly what we need to do, but we've seen success in the people that we've worked with. And compared to multiple sclerosis medications, none of which actually prevent the progression of the disease, I think it's a nice sort of add-on to what you might do with a traditional neurologist.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I understand that you're now the incoming president for the Physicians for Ancestral Health. Can you tell us a little bit about the organization and then how you became interested or involved in it in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Physicians for Ancestral Health is a group of doctors based mainly in the UK, but we've sort of spread across Europe a little bit too. And it's MDs and DOs, so I guess more traditionally trained physicians. And the idea is basically to create or foster exposure and discussions around ancestral health. And, basically what the mission is that we believe that at least some part of our healthcare process should be informed by the fact that we evolved to be here. So we know that as a species, we evolved outdoors. It was light during the day. It was dark at night. We ate the food that was around us. And sometimes we didn't eat at all. We moved to live. We had a community. We had, love and social interaction. And there was often like we had a purpose as part of a community. So, all of those things, I think, are potentially being lost in parts of Western medicine. And we're just trying to to bring some of that back into the way that physicians work with their patients. And the way that I got into it was I was giving a talk at a paleo conference, actually, in the UK. And the now president, Polina Sayas, who's a family physician in New Hampshire, came up to me and said, will you come to the conference and talk about multiple sclerosis? So that's what I did. And then, you know, as you do when you're doing a PhD, things fall by the wayside. And as I finished up my PhD, I spent a little bit less time with them. But now I'm coming back. I'll be the president from next year. And the idea is really to expand, you know, help people, you know, give something to their physician. If they're interested in some of these principles, they can come and speak to us and show that, you know, it's not just quacks who talk about light and dark and food and, you know, and love and meaning and social isolation. And, you know, actually there's some really, if you want the science, there's some really robust science behind it. But if you just want to sort of find some principles that you can apply to your patients, then we can do that too. So we're just trying to create a sort of a community of doctors that are starting to think about this stuff.
And I really like this because on the website, Physicians for Ancestral Health stress that they're not seeking to replace proven treatments, but to identify natural dietary, nutritional, environmental interventions that can complement and improve standard medical therapies. So you've kind of touched on this a little bit, but can you give us some examples of natural interventions that complement standard therapies?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is really important to point out that we love modern medicine. It does some stuff absolutely amazingly well, but there are some things that it does less well. And we can definitely support that with some of these principles. So, you know, we talked about diet and, you know, even in rheumatology, elimination diets have been used for decades to treat some inflammatory diseases. So, you know, you might try some of that if you have some kind of autoimmune condition, low FODMAP diets in people with irritable bowel syndrome, you know, in certain athletes, too, they have a high risk of gastrointestinal problems. You know, other diets for inflammatory bowel diseases, ketogenic diets for certain diseases, metabolic disease. And then you might go back to something like circadian rhythm. And we know that night shift work or feeding somebody in the intensive care unit overnight rather than during the day can cause metabolic problems. And then, you know, you can go all the way up to, you know, helping somebody foster some social interaction, you know, build a social network because that's what's going to be there to support them as they get older or if they're sick, and that's definitely going to affect their outcome too. So anything there, you can identify where the risk factors are in your patients and then you can focus on those.
Your PhD focused on the physiology of hypoxic ischemic brain injury in newborn babies using a rat model. Can you tell us a bit more about that disease and how it's studied in the lab?
So hypoxic ischemic brain injury in babies, you might call it hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, which basically just means that the brain function is affected. It occurs in about 1 to 4 per 1,000 term births where the baby is actually born alive. And about half of those will have, you know, a moderate or severe decrease in brain function, so encephalopathy we'd call it. And then around 50% of those will end up either dying or with some kind of severe cognitive or motor disability. So when we're studying this in the lab, I think it's a great example as a disease because there are multiple models in multiple animals that are all used to try a new treatment before it then goes into humans. And there aren't that many diseases where that's the case. So we have a rat model, which is the one that I focused my PhD on. Then there's a newborn piglet model that's done by some people in London. My boss has done it in both, or my PhD supervisor did it in both Bristol and Oslo. There's a group in Johns Hopkins too. And then there's a sheep model as well, which is actually really interesting because it's all done in utero. So you basically create an injury in a fetal sheep and it stays inside the ewe. So the ewe kind of provides the incubator to sort of look after the sheep over time as the injury develops, and actually makes it slightly easier to study certain things. So all of those are kind of used in conjunction, and the larger animal models are actually used to develop current therapies. So therapeutic hypothermia is the standard of care for these babies in the Western world. But as in most areas, the rodents have really come to the fore. So recently, if you're digging into the mechanisms of injury or the mechanisms of a treatment, then we've really been using the rodent model, and that's the rat model that I've tended to focus on. And this sort of is creating quite a nice workflow, because then if you have a potential therapy, you'll try it first in rats, then you'll try it in larger animal models, and that will give you a good basis to work into human clinical trials. And that, I think that's something that we should be doing in as much research as possible, preclinical research.
And it's really good that you have these multiple models to work through. So from what I understand, the current treatment for these infants is therapeutic hypothermia. Can you tell us a bit about how that treatment works?
Basically, what you do is a baby's born and the physician diagnoses some degree of likely brain injury. And then the baby's cooled down for 3 days, 72 hours to 33.5 degrees Celsius, thereabout, which is about 92.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And hypothermia, or cooling, has actually been used for hundreds of years for various things. So pain, obviously, certain tumors back before we had any sort of chemotherapy or anything like that. And actually, even back in the 1600s, there's an interesting report where a physician's assistant took a stillborn baby and essentially put it in some ice water. It was winter, so put it in some ice water that was outside the house. And then apparently the baby sort of came back to life and cried and then, was perfectly happy and normal. And actually, very similarly, so back in the 50s and 60s, there was a Swedish researcher called Björn Westin who presented over a couple of decades about 70 cases of babies born in a similar manner. So they were obviously injured at birth for some reason, and he put them in ice cold water until they essentially started breathing spontaneously or crying, and then he would take them out of the water and they'd just be allowed to sort of rewarm at their own pace based on the environmental temperature. And as much as they could do back then, about 80% of those babies ended up with normal neurology, which is pretty amazing. And then sort of as time went on, they started to apply or investigate hypothermia in animal models, so things like a piglet model or the sheep model. And the current protocol was actually developed in the sheep model, the cooling for 3 days, and then it obviously went into clinical trials. There were three main clinical trials, and then it became the standard of therapy in 2010. The way therapeutic hypothermia is thought to work is actually via many mechanisms, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's actually a successful therapy, because for most diseases that have multifactorial aspects, trying to just focus on one particular aspect has never really seemed to work. But what it does seem to do is it reduces the metabolic demand of the injured brain. So for every degree Celsius you decrease core temperature, you reduce metabolic rate by about 5%. So if these cells are damaged in the brain, later on there's an inflammatory process, and then they actually increase their metabolic rate, and that can actually accelerate them dying because they essentially run out of energy. We call it secondary energy failure. So it can also suppress inflammation. And then if there are cells in the brain that are going to die, there's basically a continuum of cell death everywhere from apoptosis that people might have heard of. It's basically programmed cell death. So the cell sort of dies and shrinks up in a nice little package and can kind of be exported away, all the way down to necrosis, where the cell basically just explodes and creates a whole mess of stuff and loads of inflammation, and that sort of creates more problems in itself. So it can reduce apoptosis, so it can reduce cells dying by that way in itself. And then also, if cells might die by a slightly messier form, or which might create more inflammation or more problems, it can actually move them so they die by a way that potentially causes fewer problems. So all of those things together, it has this sort of nice synergistic effect on both the living cells and the cells that then might be dying.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
Considering that hypothermia was already the standard of care by the time you started your PhD, what made you choose to focus on it, to study it further during your PhD?
That's a great question, and many people would probably ask the same. And I think when I went into my PhD, I was very interested in studying xenon, which was another therapy that's being used in clinical trials in addition to hypothermia currently in infants. But when I got back into the lab setting, I was reminded of the fact that hypothermia only produces an absolute risk reduction of death and disability of about 15%. So it helps, but it's not great. And we know that the current treatment protocols might not do much for babies with really severe brain injury. So, you know, trying to find a way to optimize the therapy, to maybe provide a therapy that would work for infants with very severe brain injury. But at the same time, they were running a big clinical trial over here in the US to give infants either longer, so 5 days cooling rather than 3 days, or deeper cooling, so 32 degrees Celsius rather than 33.5 degrees Celsius in a four group trial. And when you looked at the animal data to support doing either longer or deeper cooling, there really wasn't any there. And, you know, this is a trial taking millions of dollars and hundreds of babies are being enrolled. And as much as, you know, one PhD student can contribute to the literature, I really wanted to make sure that they were doing the right thing. And, you know, actually, since that trial has come out, we have shown in rats and other groups have shown both in piglets and in sheep that deeper and longer cooling probably isn't beneficial. So I think that really gives a kind of a warning that we can get the right data from animal models if we do the right experiments initially, and then that might stop us running human clinical trials that then end up not working, which obviously, you know, those patients could have had another therapy that was maybe better, or, you know, you've saved money for the NIH and they could spend that on something else. So I think that's really important. That's something really important going forward, as we have just limited resources to figure out best ways to make people healthier.
Well, on that topic, knowing what you know through your research in animal models, how would you research the optimization of therapeutic hypothermia when it comes to humans?
So I think, like I said, particularly in this disease, we have good animal models. So obviously start there. And then one thing that I think has maybe not been fully investigated is the fact that when you look at the original randomized controlled trials, you obviously have a hypothermia group and then you have a normothermia group. So you have the control group who are kept at a normal temperature. However, that normothermia group was actually kept at 37 degrees, around 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's actually a bit warm for a newborn baby. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that when you have brain injury and then you get warmed up a little bit, which you have to be to standardize the temperature, that might make the injury even worse. Mm-hmm. So as we move forwards, we're seeing that people sort of allowing babies to spontaneously cool, sort of regulate their own temperature as much as possible, preventing them from overcooling. So I think we may have exacerbated or inflated the effect of hypothermia because actually we heated the control group. So I think that's something that needs to be taken into account. There's also definitely a possibility that you can be guided by the injury itself. So, you know, it's very rare that the same treatment is ideal for everybody. So we need to find some way to personalize that. And I think that can be tailored to the degree of injury. And you see the more injured that an infant is, generally the more their temperature drops after they're born. So I think that could maybe help guide us. And then some other really important stuff is to standardize how we measure temperature. So when you look at the trials run in the UK, they measured temperature with a rectal probe, whereas if you look at trials done in the US, they measure temperature with an esophageal probe. So they put a temperature probe in the esophagus. Mm-hmm. When you compare those two methods, when you're targeting 33.5 degrees Celsius from the esophagus, you end up being about almost a degree colder in the rectum, and nobody knows which of those is a better way to measure. Nobody, you know, that's a reasonable amount of difference in temperature, but nobody knows which is optimal because that's just where the trials were run. And now when we're adding therapies on, so erythropoietin is being run out of here at the University of Washington, my current PI, stem cell therapies, xenon, like I mentioned, melatonin, maybe some antioxidant therapies like NAST or cysteine. If we don't standardize all the therapies, if we don't standardize the hypothermia, then we're much less likely to see the benefit of those other therapies. So making sure that we do all of that first, I think is going to increase the likelihood that we manage to advance the therapy and find the best protocol for these babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So you've now crossed the Atlantic to become a senior fellow in the pediatrics department of the University of Washington. How did that come apart?
So I moved for the most male of reasons. I moved for a girl. This is my fiance who I met at a developmental brain injury conference 3 years ago now. And I had always thought about coming to the US because the research environment here is so great. But obviously we met and we had a long distance relationship while I was finishing my PhD. And then I was planning to come over and move to be with her in Seattle. She's just she's a junior professor and assistant professor in the chemical engineering department. And when I was sort of looking for a job, there's a woman here, Sandra Jewell, who is in the field that I did my PhD in, and she has collaborated with my fiance Elizabeth on a couple of things. And so she basically has admitted to giving me a job just because she liked my girlfriend, which is actually very similar to my original PhD supervisor, who gave me a job as an undergraduate because she liked my mum. They say that behind every great man is an even greater woman, and you know I've had all these brilliant women behind me that have really sort of helped me in my career, but that's essentially what brought me over.
Well, that's as honest as you can get. So I think this is really interesting. Your current work involves developing a ferret model of brain injury in premature babies. Actually, when I was doing my postdoc, we did a fair bit of work with ferret model of brain injury, so I have a little bit of familiarity with that. So I'm curious as to what motivated your change in both target disease and also choice of animal. And can you explain why the ferret?
Absolutely. The primary focus of the lab here is premature brain injury, and it's a little bit more common than the injury that I was studying before. So maybe 10% of babies are born prematurely. And if a baby is born very prematurely or very underweight, so they're born before 28 weeks gestation, they again have about a 50% risk of death or severe disability. So, you know, it's relatively common. The reason why we're developing a model in the ferret is because the brain injury that you see in premature babies is mainly in the white matter, which sort of sits underneath the main outer gray matter in the cortex, which people might think, oh, you know, the gray matter on the outside of the brain. The white matter is sort of underneath that and creates a number of the connections across the hemispheres, and there's various different structures under there. But when you're, you know, we like to use rodents in animal research, but the rodent doesn't, you know, the rats and mice don't really have very much white matter, so it's quite difficult to get a relevant model in those species. The alternative again is to go to bigger animal models. So we talked about the sheep. There's a version of premature brain injury model in the sheep, but again, it can be very expensive. So the ferret is basically born in large numbers like the rodent, but the ferret brain essentially looks like a mini human brain. And it has, you know, very similar structures, and it's, you know, almost as well developed and complex. And so then that allows us to create an injury that's probably going to be much closer to what it is what's happening in humans. They're also really cute, which I think is really important. And, you know, they're very intelligent, so you can do a wide battery of tests to kind of see whether a therapy that you're developing is working. And I'm not sure what type of brain injury you have experience in, Dawn, but I know there's a lot of interest in traumatic brain injury, particularly in the ferret, because of the very similar structure to the human brain. So I think the ferret models they're kind of starting to take off, and I think that will be a good sort of middle ground for animal research when it comes to trying to develop therapies for brain injury.
I had a friend that once had a bunch of ferrets that lived in his house uncaged. And let's just say they bear close watching.
They are very intelligent creatures.
and they do have a very specific smell. We'll put it that
way. Yes, that's a very nice way of putting that, by the way.
Let's talk a little bit more about xenon. You've mentioned it a couple times. A noble gas that reacts with very little and is therefore often referred to as an inert gas. So although it has many applications from headlights to spacecraft propulsion, today let's just focus on the biological aspects.
Yeah, and just by the way, Ken, I think you and I have talked about xenon before. I thought this is kind of interesting because when you were at NASA, isn't it true that I think some of your colleagues were involved in the AI systems for a spacecraft called Deep Space One and that used xenon as fuel, right?
Yes, that was a really cool mission of the kind that we don't get to do very often. It was a technology demonstrator. That was really the first application of spacecraft autonomy and a very early, if not the first, use of ion propulsion. And the xenon was the fuel for the ion propulsion system.
That's pretty cool. So now we're going to talk about it in the biological context. So we know that xenon is particularly interesting in that it's an anesthetic that appears to be highly cytoprotective if used early enough after injury, at least partly through activation of HIF-1 alpha, which is a transcription factor that turns on production of EPO. So it would make sense that xenon would be helpful in folks suffering hypoxic ischemic brain injuries and perhaps heart attack victims as well. So Tommy, I understand that you had initially intended to focus your PhD on the mechanisms behind the neuroprotective actions of xenon. Why did you move off that focus for your studies? It certainly sounded like it could be interesting.
Yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating gas in that it seems to sit in certain receptors in the brain that are overactivated in the setting of hypoxic ischemic brain injury. So hypoxia, obviously meaning reduced oxygen, and ischemia meaning reduced blood flow. And this was actually a therapy that was developed by my PhD supervisor. As an undergraduate, I was part of the studies where we tried it again in our rat model, tried it in a piglet model, and it's now in clinical trials in the UK. And initially, I was going to look at the real sort of dig down into the mechanism of xenon and try and figure out exactly what it's doing, because it seems to interact with a number of different receptors and things, you know, maybe in the mitochondria, but and various ion channels, but we're not really sure exactly all the things it does. So that's where I was going to go initially. But then, as I was talking about earlier, I sort of got back into the hypothermia field, and I essentially kind of decided that digging down into the mechanism is obviously very interesting, but what I wanted to do as much as possible was try and optimize the therapy to make sure that, you know, we could really get as good protection, neuroprotection as possible, at least based on the work that I was able to do. So while the mechanism is certainly interesting and definitely needs to be dug into even further, I went a little bit more practical and was hoping I could maybe sort of improve a therapy to try and optimize treatment.
That makes good sense. Mm-hmm. I actually have a friend named Xenon, and he's a great guy, and he's probably my only friend appearing in the periodic table. You got to wonder what his mom was thinking, you know. But interestingly, xenon's activation of HIF-1 alpha is also what makes xenon potentially ergogenic, and in some circles regarded as a performance-enhancing substance. The Russians have admitted to using xenon in their athletes, at least until WADA banned it along with argon. The Russians say xenon also modulates cortisol and boosts testosterone. What are your thoughts on xenon's effectiveness in enhancing performance in athletes?
This was actually a really big deal right when I was in Oslo doing my PhD, because there was the Sochi Winter Olympics. And at that point, in cross-country skiing, Norway is usually the country to beat. It's really their specialty. It's then, you know, probably their national sport is cross-country skiing. And, you know, in the run-up to the Olympics, the Russians were actually very open about their use of xenon as a performance enhancer. And, you know, then there was all this uproar about whether this was legal. And obviously, when the Russians were maybe beating a few of the Norwegian athletes in the Olympics, then that added insult to injury. Very soon after that, WADA banned xenon and argon, and I think it was essentially any agent that boosts HIF-1 alpha or EPO production, because we know that those can, you know, down the line, they're going to stimulate hemoglobin production, and if you have more hemoglobin, then you have a greater power output. So it's definitely a real ergogenic aid. The Russian literature and research on xenon, I think, is much more advanced than we maybe have access to here in the West. They also have most of the world's xenon refineries, so they have access to all the xenon too. And it can be very expensive. I think last time I checked, it was $20 or $30 a liter. So you can get through that very quickly. As far as the effects on cortisol and testosterone, I don't think that's really been looked at in the literature that I have access to, but I would certainly believe that it has those ergogenic benefits, at least because of the effect on hemoglobin. And we have replicated some of that in clinical trials. So there was one randomized clinical trial in Germany where they randomized people to anesthesia, and a group got xenon as part of their anesthetics, and they ended up a couple of weeks later with higher levels of hemoglobin. So it definitely seems to have that kind of hemoglobin boosting effect. And I did, initially, I thought it would be very difficult to test for xenon, because when you're breathing it in, actually, you clear it very, very quickly. So if you've been given xenon as an anesthetic, it's just a couple of breaths before the xenon clears and you wake up. So it's a very, very rapid recovery. However, I think there are some studies showing that you can detect xenon in the urine and the blood maybe 24 to 48 hours after somebody has taken it. So if you catch somebody very early, they might be able to detect the doping. But I'm still sort of wondering how much of that is actually going to be done. But I was, going to say that sort of a word of warning, if anybody sort of feels like huffing some xenon, it does have a very variable anesthetic effect. So obviously you could pass out breathing it. And then, it's a very dense gas. There's a possibility that you could suffocate on it. And, it's very expensive and you'll need a CO2 scavenging unit with we have a rebreather circuit that we use for infants. So the xenon sort of keeps looping around and around so you don't lose it to the atmosphere. So hopefully not intending to give anybody ideas, but it's just sort of like the pros and cons of xenon.
Wow, what a party pooper.
Yeah, I know. And those are some of the cons. I think, as one report characterized it, xenon increases heart and lung capacity, reduces muscle fatigue, boosts testosterone, causes an improvement in mood. So if all that's true, it sounds pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Despite the cons.
Yeah. Just as an aside, ketogenic diets also activate HIF-1 alpha. And one wonders, given the language from WADA that you recounted a minute ago, if WADA will see exogenous ketones as triggering the same clause as xenon.
That's a great point that I'll be very interested to watch if they can find evidence of that.
I mean, for sure, it triggers HIF-1 alpha. I just wonder how they'll treat it.
Yeah.
So Tommy, we're going to change the subject just a little bit. You've been involved in collaborative work with people in a number of different fields using what you have referred to as a systems analysis approach to look at the etiology of disease processes and multiple sclerosis and insulin resistance, as well as the application of nanotechnology to drug delivery and neurological diseases. So can you expand a little on that?
Absolutely. And I know there's going to be a lot of people who have experience in systems analysis who may not agree with the way that I use it. And I definitely was taught systems analysis for dummies. I'll say it's basically if you had to teach somebody how to analyze a problem when they have no background in engineering, which is obviously me, then this is kind of how I was taught it. And again, we use this as part of approaching multiple sclerosis as a disease. And it's basically the idea is to avoid reductionist thinking in whatever scenario you're using the tool. So if we're using it in medicine or science, we're trying to connect all the potential dots, build a model, see how those interact. So you create nodes in a system, how those interact both in terms of direction, so increasing or decreasing something, and then magnitude, which then allows you to potentially model it in a computer at the same time. So this sort of stuff that we tend to look at tend to be environmental, genetic, physiological, how all those factors interact in a disease process. And then also, I've sort of helped out on using that in the drug delivery field. And then the idea, particularly when it comes to health, is identify the important nodes, the things that we can really focus on, and then try and distill out some interventions. And, and maybe using this process, you can sort of find out something unexpected, find out where there's a knowledge gap, and then you can sort of work from there, but it gives you the really big picture to kind of start with.
In listening to your explanation, it seems like you're employing what might be thought of as a systems thinking approach to avoid the dangers of reductionist approaches to medicine. There's that great story about blind men and the elephant.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just the part that you can feel makes you think that it's something different. So when you feel the leg, then it's a tree rather than actually being an elephant, because you can't see the bigger picture. And I have... I do have a story about the dangers of reductionism, but maybe even the dangers also of thinking that we can fully understand the human body as well as we'd like to be able to, or think that we can understand it as well as we are ever going to currently, which is directly stolen from a friend of mine, Dr. Josh Turknet, who is he's our neurologist in residence, as we call him at Nourish Balance Thrive. And he tells this story about aliens coming down to Earth, and they find the game Angry Birds. And and as you do. And, you know, I think this ages Josh slightly, because I'm not sure Angry Birds is a thing anymore, but it was a few years ago anyway. So they come down and they find Angry Birds, and they split into two teams, and they say, okay, in a month's time, we're going to compete at Angry Birds and see who can win, who's the best team. So the team splits off, and one team decides that they're just going to play the game. They're going to get up every day, play Angry Birds all day, and in a month's time, you know, they're going to have it figured out pretty well. And that's how that's their strategy. The other team decides that they're going to dig down into the source code of the game. And then when they really understand the code, they've deconstructed the game entirely, then in real time, they're going to manipulate the game code so that they can win the game in the competition. And you can probably, you know, immediately figure out where this is going to go, because if anybody has ever tried to manipulate game source code in real time to try and win the game, they'll probably realize that it's almost completely impossible. Mm-hmm. And I think a similar approach is often being tried in medicine, which is that, you know, single point interventions, or assuming that we understand the source code of the body or biochemistry or physiology such that we can manipulate it in real time to get the result that we want. And that's somewhere where we just aren't there at the moment. So what we like to say is that you should play the game. And playing the game of being a human involves eating real food, moving to live, having light when it's light and dark when it's dark, and going back to all those other things that we talked about, like social connection and love and meaning. And that's the stuff that really counts. So when you're trying to build a robust, healthy human, you know, maybe we don't understand all the biology behind what is required to make us as healthy as possible, but we have a really good idea of how we can play the game.
Those are some seriously cool aliens that are able to derive the source code from the runtime. I don't know how they do that, but they're bad.
I love that analogy, though. That's awesome.
It's a good story.
It's really good.
STEM Talk.
Wow, we've really covered a lot of ground with Tommy, and that is just the start of this two-part interview.
Absolutely. It was great fun talking with Tommy and diving into a wide range of subjects, which included, among others, his training and education, current approaches to treating babies with brain injuries, a systems view of biology, and xenon gas and its application in medicine, as well as its potential role in sport as a performance-enhancing substance.
If you enjoyed this interview as much as we did, I invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage, where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us.
Also, be on the lookout for part two of this episode. In part two, we discuss insulin resistance, ketogenic diets, and exogenous ketones, benefits of donating blood, machine learning applied to blood test results, overtraining, supplements, and his work with Christopher Kelly at Nourish Balance Thrive.
This is Don Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.